Hello and welcome to the Ethical Eater Podcast. I'm your host, Josh, and today is June 8th, 2020. You're listening to Episode 3, A Conversation Around Vegetarianism.
The Ethical Eater Podcast is brought to you by Honey Locust Home. HoneyLocustHome.com is your source for handcrafted, artisan-made small-batch soaps and body products. Use the promo code ETHIC, E-T-H-I-C, and receive 10% off your order. During these crazy shelter-in-place times, be sure to check out Honey Locust Home's quarterly subscription box. Every 3 months, you will receive a box of handcrafted soaps, including your favorite varieties. How cool is that? Go to HoneyLocustHome.com now to check it out.
I want to thank my guest, Kevin Briggs, fellow podcaster, ethical eater, and all around pretty cool dude. I've known Kevin for a while. He's a musician and educator. I wouldn't go so far as to say my spiritual advisor, but somebody I definitely look to in terms of all things mindfulness and a real deep thinker. So welcome, Kevin, to the Ethical Eater Podcast.
Hey, thanks, Josh, so much for having me. This is I've really been looking forward to this, and I appreciate the very generous introduction.
Cool. Well, before I get too far into it, I got to thank you for two things right up front. One, really being the inspiration and helping me with some of the tech behind getting the podcast going. I know that you've been my mentor in terms of the jumping into the podcast space. And then secondly, I really wanted to thank you for taking the time to have this conversation around vegetarianism. And you know, you're one of probably very few people that I know that I would feel comfortable kind of jumping into this topic. And I'm really excited to get into it as well.
Yeah, same. And, you know, this is, like I said, something I've really been looking forward to. And I actually, to prep for your podcast episode on this, I recorded one last night on the Seeds of Liberation podcast on really the same topic, where I just am the only one talking. So it's a little bit more all about me, I guess, and what I think. But I'm really looking forward to the discussion. And in fact, for me, this is the whole reason why I started doing podcasting, was because to engage in the dialogue with people and honestly to have fun. It's a whole lot of fun talking about these things that we care so much about.
Cool. Well, before we get into the topic, I got to share two quick stories. One, I remember the days of, it seems forever ago, that we were sitting around a campfire at Cornstalk Music Fest. And I'm hoping that we get back to those days. So as soon as you're out there attending or playing festivals, keep me in mind, because I had a blast that weekend when we were hanging out. And you're always welcome to sell soap for us as well. I remember you were probably the best one-day soap salesman we've ever had at a Honey Locust Home.
I was employee of the month that day for sure.
Absolutely. And then my second story, and I probably told you this before, but I'm holding off this hope that your band Feats of Strength will hit it big, because I remember I feel like I remember a moment where I introduced you to Brad, our friend Brad, at another friend Todd's house. And I think somebody told me that I was wrong. It might have been Brad or you, that you guys had actually met previously.
No, it's not true. You introduced us. You introduced
us. Well, regardless, that's going to be my claim to fame someday when you guys hit it big, is that I'm going to claim to have been the person to introduce you to. Well, that's awesome, man. Well, thanks. I think the first thing I wanted to kind of do when we talk about the concept of vegetarianism and the diet is, you know, kind of unpack it. I have and kind of state kind of where my thinking is with it, and we can go from there and jump into any parts of this you want to. But when I look at the diet, a vegetarian diet, I really kind of separate it into three different portions, three different categories. One being an ethical objection to eating animals. Some people, and you may fall into this camp, I fully respect folks that don't believe that they should be consuming another living being. That's probably the area that I'm most understand, although I don't personally believe that. That's, I have a difference of a belief there. Then secondly, the those that look to pursue a vegetarian diet for health reasons. And I think, as we've talked a little bit previously, you know, there's many different genetic makeups of folks. And I personally know people that have thrived on a vegetarian diet and feel like it's really benefited them. So I fully see that for some folks who approach it from a health standpoint, that there's a lot of merit there. And then lastly, and I think this is the most recent kind of aspect of the diet, or at least it's getting a lot of kind of notoriety in a world of climate change, and that's the environmental impact. And that's probably the area that I have the most, maybe disagreements would be the best way to phrase it. And that's largely due to how poorly we do raise animals in this country through factory farming and CAFO operations that are just not natural at all. But, you know, I guess my first question is, you know, why do you think there's so much kind of challenge around this diet in terms of all these different things that are crammed into one kind of one label? And is it, you know, I feel like that's probably where some tension arises around it, because there's really no clear definition of vegetarianism.
And yeah. And so the question is, what do I see as some of the, I guess, variables involved in having a label and then sort of trying to conceptualize something in that way?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I think anytime we label what we're doing, it can have a positive and negative impact, or it can have different kinds of impacts. Because the reason why we do it is to have a clear understanding of whatever the thing is. And I think to some degree, it definitely, you know, feeds into our identity and all these different considerations. So I think we have this tendency to want to label things and say, I'm a this, or I'm a that. And then the downside of the label, though, is it boxes you in. And so then all of a sudden, there's some kind of contradiction going on, or you have some even moral dilemma with whatever your choice is. But no, you've chosen this way, you've boxed yourself in. And we're not going to talk about politics, but it's a pretty clear example. It's kind of like that, where people just have their stance, and then regardless of what's even happening, their stance becomes more important than what, like, what's actually happening sometimes. So I think it's a challenge in diets too, because in a way, our choices with diets impact everybody around us. Whatever we in the world, whatever we choose to, however we choose to eat, has some kind of impact. And so then we're living in harmony with, or maybe sometimes opposition with, people who eat the same way or people who eat differently. And so diet, it just seems to be one of those things that people get particularly intense about. You know, so I think it can be problematic to maybe cling so tightly onto things, I guess.
For sure. Yeah. You know, I like what you said, that it's this need to label. And I think that, you know, the drawing the comparison to politics or even religion in some case, that people hold on to these. And, you know, just through our conversations, I know that we share this kind of curiosity of really wanting to dissect some of these things and understand, you know, why we make the choices we do, and you know kind of that mindfulness that, you know, you and I have talked about before. But tell me a little bit about, you know, kind of how you came to your choice of diet. And I know that, you know, you in an attempt to not label you incorrectly, you described it as, you know, a vegetarian with vegan tendencies or leaning towards veganism. Just tell me a little bit about kind of how you came to that decision in your own life.
Sure. And on, it's good that I fleshed this out last night on my episode, because I ended up talking for about 40 minutes about this. And so what I can do is pare that way down. But because the way I arrived at my diet, it's been an evolution. And I'll say very briefly, when I was, you know, I grew up in a home where there was very little discussion about diet, traditional home. My mom and dad, you know, worked together. They still are. And they, my mom did all the cooking while my dad worked and watched TV and whatever. And so whatever she made for us is just what we ate, but we never really spoke about why those were the things we were eating or, and how we felt about it or anything like that. It was just like, oh, she'd make meatloaf, you know, or she bought a wok once and she'd make Chinese food. And so, it was kind of though, I would say, an critical food environment. We just didn't discuss food and thoughts around it. And so that was my, and so I had a poor diet for a long time, where I was just sort of eat whatever. I don't really like sweets. And so that wasn't too much of a thing. I'm not real big on fried food. So me eating whatever I want isn't necessarily the worst thing ever. But anyway, so what happened was around the time I was in my early 20s, I walked into a bookstore and saw this book called Buddhism Plain and Simple. And this book changed my life. And it's really the first part of three reasons why I eat the way I do. And the first part is a spiritual reason. And so when I started getting into that belief system, when I started getting into that spiritual approach, one of the central tenets in Buddhism is cause no suffering to yourself or others, and that includes ending life, like ending the life of something that's alive. And so there's this real philosophical, very core belief. I mean, without that belief, basically, or that tenet, Buddhism really doesn't exist in the same way that it does. So that was a core thing. And so I started getting this idea about how I felt about taking life to eat it, kind of thing, is the way I looked at it. And so the when I knew this was really becoming a thing was I just had taken yearly trips, sometimes twice a year, down to Florida for a week or my grandparents, and now I go down there to see my parents. And we were like a fishing family. And so just going out in the Gulf of Mexico and fishing. And I knew that I was starting to change when I was on a fishing trip with my dad in my late 20s. And I caught some fish that we would have been able to keep. And I didn't want to keep it. I didn't want to put it in like the fish well, you know, to take home. So I wanted to put it back. And it was all because of this spiritual kind of maybe awakening that I had had. And that's the first thing. The second thing is there's a physicality to what my decisions were, which is I had a health concern, a digestive disorder, I guess, and I kept getting diverticulosis, and I eventually got the surgery to have it removed. And I did all that in my early 30s. Leading into that, while it was going on, and then after it, I started leaning towards food with fiber in it. And so that kind of excludes meat and dairy. And so I was like, okay, well, this is another reason. I kind of don't want to eat it anyway, but now I have this like other reason that maybe I can talk to people about, and they won't look at me like I'm crazy or whatever. And so then, so there was this physicality where I wanted to eat plant-based things for the betterment of my digestive system. And then the third thing, and this is, I think, where we can launch off from, is what I would just say a cognitive interest. And what I mean by that is I have just an interest around. The ideas of ethical eating and about physical health and about the spiritual context of eating as I see it. And so that puts me in pursuit of ideas around it, such as ideas about, like you mentioned, the environment, or ideas about big agriculture, you know, beef industry, pork, milk, all these huge industries. But these are just ideas that I have. Like, I don't really know a whole lot about those things. I just know that they're relevant and that there are some maybe theories around those things out there. But I have an interest in that too, because I think a part of all of it is my effort to sort of be a good citizen of the world as a living creature amongst all the others. Sure. And so I want to make the best decision for myself and for other people with everything that I eat, really.
I think that's, yeah, I mean, it, and we've talked a little bit about this in the past, and I'm so glad to kind of jump into these concepts, you know, and hearing your spiritual kind of component, it's, you know, it's interesting. And, you know, you got to respect when people come to those decisions. I've had friends that, you know, have pulled up next to a cattle truck at an intersection and just looked and connected with an animal, you know, in their eyes and recognized life there and felt like they had to make that change. And, you know, as a meat eater, you know, I share a lot of reverence for animals, and, you know, even as a hunter, and, you know, the amount of your soul that you kind of commit to taking that act and not taking it lightly. And, you know, when you look at, you know, where as a society we are, where we just have lost all reverence for our food, we take it for granted. And, you know, it's, I think where we're different, obviously, you know, it's apparent where we're different, but, you know, what we share and that green space that you kind of talk about, where we've got a lot of room to grow and learn, is, okay, how can we as individuals kind of come into balance with nature and the earth, and how can we as a society do it? And we're just, there's so much that we're doing wrong. And, you know, I said in one of my previous podcasts that, you know, even though I'm not vegetarian, I think we need to move drastically towards that way of life. Even if it's, you know, not 100%, you know, probably eating much more plant-based, ethical foods that are grown responsibly and don't destroy the earth. And, you know, that's an area that, and I'm sure you've seen it, you know, having, you know, been on this journey for a little while. I have a couple of labels, unfortunately. I talk sometimes about people as carbitarians, or as I call them, you know, more recently, carbivores, that, you know, vegans or vegetarians that will, you know, put thoughtfulness and mindfulness into the exclusion of meat, but then load up their diet with tons of processed food that may be full of sugar and soy and all kinds of other things. And, you know, it I think that's one of the areas that is a non-vegetarian, but also somebody who is very mindful of everything I consume, I see some inconsistencies and struggle. But, you know, hearing that, you know, guys like you are out there trying to be mindful of everything that you do and not causing harm to others or not causing harm to the earth, it's refreshing. And like I said, I think, you know, we've probably got more in common than we do differences in this space, because that last piece of your puzzle in terms of learning, exploring, and finding ways that we can do better as individuals and as a society around food, it just amazes me how little thought people put into their food choices.
Yeah, you know, and I want to add to that, because it's a great point that you make about the vegan junk food eaters. Basically, I mean, it's an inconsistency, right? It's a contradiction, really. And because as veganism is also a philosophy, and so it's a way of eating, but it's also involves like no animal products for anything that I need, like not leather in my shoes, like that kind of thing. And it's like your earlier question about putting a label on something. And so the vegans have the label that they want to eat plant-based food, and that they feel strongly about that. And they have a lot of very, you know, very staunch reasons for it and all these things. But then there's like a bag of potato chips, right? Or there's even maybe some kind of donut that doesn't have any dairy in it. I don't know. But, and so what I think though about it is this, I think just the real answer is that we're all doing the best we can. Right. And so it's, like for people who are of a mindset that they're paying attention, they're being mindful of what they eat, they're thinking about the ethics of it, we're on a path, right? We're not like, we haven't arrived. At least that's not how I feel. Like, I don't feel like I have it all figured out or something. I'm sort of doing it as I go and making what I think is the best choice at the time. And then also making what I would term a lot of like falling off the diet a lot too sometimes. I mean, it's not, I'm not thinking of it like I have a quote unquote diet really. It's just that there's some things I just won't eat is what it is. And then, but I don't always stick to that. I mean, for example, I had a breakfast burrito the other day from Sheetz. And like talk about a complete 180 off of the ethical eating, right? But it the point is that I think we can be easy on like even we agree or disagree, it's a secondary concern, right? It's like the thing to really do is to be in dialogue and to increase understanding and building community, and then we have this more insightful, more compassionate maybe relationship with each other. Because I just think as far as the discrepancies in what people do with their diets, I just think we're doing the best we can. And even those people who were kind of like seem full of it, or they're coming on too strong, or they're obviously not doing what they say they're doing, or they just seem like their idea is way off base. Like even those people, you know, we can approach gently is what I think. Oh, it's like, sure. It's like, okay, there's all these discrepancies, but you know, we're all doing the best we can. And it's, I think the differences, as I was saying, are secondary concerns. The primary concern is the choices that we're making for ourselves, because that's what we can ultimately control. Like if there's one thing we can just about definitely control, it's what we put in our mouths to eat, right? And so and that's it. Like we can't control. Some people, it seems like maybe they want others to think the way they think about it or something, like to agree with them, but that's illogical. You can't tell other people what to do in terms of that. So the only thing you can only just control your own consumption, really.
Oh, for sure. And you know, I like the pathway kind of analogy, and it's absolutely, and you know, we all do the best we can. And you know, even people, you know, I have, you know, family and friends sometimes I think that are nervous about, you know, what do we serve? You know, they know I have strong beliefs about local and organic and sustainable and ethical choices, but you know, when you're out, you're social, it's like, no, man, I'll eat what you serve. I'm a guest in your home and don't, you know, it's, you know, and I think what you touched on is that this need at times to try to project, you know, one's individual beliefs onto others. And that's, you know, that's kind of where, you know, it gets to be a little bit sticky, but absolutely in terms of, you know, if we made more of an effort to be mindful of our food choices. And I think we've talked about in the past, this concept of just being consistent, understanding what your beliefs are and strive to be consistent. I'm not a particularly, you know, religious guy. I don't really subscribe to any kind of formal religion, but I remember, I forget what the story was, but somebody was explaining that, you know, this kind of to live, you know, the 10 commandments might be a way to try to live as if, you know, live according to, you know, God's or Christ's rules. And that, you know, there's no, in that religion, in Christianity, there's a belief that, you know, you're never going to reach perfection, but it's you're striving for it. You don't ever stop trying to move in that direction. And I think you know, for folks, it has to, you know, sometimes it has to be an all or nothing thing. And, you know, as a homesteader, I raise a lot of the food that I have, and I have a great deal of reverence for that food. And it means something to me to put the work in to produce it. And, you know, oftentimes I'll talk to people and they're, well, what are you trying to do? Grow all your own food? It's like, well, no, I don't need to go all the way, man. I'm trying to make the best choices I can. And if it's, you know, having, you know, a dozen chickens and having my own laying hens so that I can know that, you know, those eggs that I'm serving myself and my family are the best possible, most nutritious, ethically raised eggs that there are, that's what I'm going to do. And I'm not trying to reach that 100% mark. I've never had a goal of trying to produce all of my own food. It's interesting how people, I think, automatically try to project this kind of all or nothing. And I think that's where a lot of us, you know, we all know that we fall short in certain areas. And, you know, I think that's sometimes how people will project that kind of shortcoming onto others, that, you know, it has to be this kind of all or nothing approach.
I agree. You know, it's, I'm thinking while you're talking about this analogy, and it is that, as you know, part-time musician, you know, I've been playing music and different instruments since high school. So I've been just doing it a while, and I just play around locally wherever it is I'm living and that kind of thing. And I want to liken what it's like to be on a musical journey, or what I would say is like, or a journey regarding anything you're passionate about, with the food journey. Because when I started playing music, I couldn't play, right? I knew I wanted to play. And so I would pick up the guitar and I would just strum chords. And I did that for months, and it didn't feel natural, but eventually my hands kind of conformed. And in about 6 months, I could play all the major chords and all that stuff, no problem. And over the years of being a musician, I changed instruments. I started playing the mandolin. I swapped out. I've had dozens of different ones, but I've also gotten into all kinds of different kinds of music that I've played. So I was like a folk player. Then I was like a jam band player. Then I was a bluegrass player. And then kind of like an alt country player. And now, right now, I'm just like a singer songwriter. But it's been this evolution of my interest in that thing. And what I've been doing the whole time is like practicing, refining, and gaining a deeper and deeper understanding of what I'm choosing to do with the instrument and the music. And I think it's the same. And, you know, I think there's a great quote by a very famous cello player who has now passed away. And I just can't remember his name, but maybe we can put it like the notes for the episode or something. he was 93 and he was still practicing 3 hours a day, which he had done since he started playing at like age 8 or something. And they said to him, "You're 93. You're the world's greatest cellist. You know, you have all these accomplishments. Why are you still practicing 3 hours a day?" And his answer was, "Because I think I'm starting to make a little progress." And I think it's a journey. We're trying to do the best. And this is why we're able to do this episode like this, because that's, in terms of, I think, ethical eating or being mindful, you're maintaining an awareness around trying to do your best. Like, you're trying to intentionally do what is the right or the good or the best kind of preferable thing to do at the time and be thoughtful about it. And so that's really the first thing that enables dialogue, is when we have our own views that we've thought about. We're clear on what those views are. We know that they're evolving views and that information changes and or like accumulates over time and whatever. And so there it is. And then you hear somebody say, "Well, but this is all the information that I care the most about, so therefore this is the decision that I'm making." It's like a conversation that's pretty easy to have if you just leave space for the other person to have a view that's not yours, and then say, "Okay, instead of dwelling on the fact that we have this difference and maybe I have a problem with this view and maybe I want to persuade this person to think the way I think, like, I'm just going to put all that down and I'm just going to offer them my presence and a genuine intention to listen to what it is they're saying." And then if we do that, then we go into the role of being a listener. We feel good about where we're at. We're genuinely listening to other people and likely getting some kind of education as well, if we're taking that approach with it. And then, so it's also information that could be useful for us. We're more connected to another human being because of our choice to be so genuinely interested in them. And it's kind of like a win-win-win, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, it's interesting that a couple thoughts kind of jump out at me. I like the cello quote, and it reminded me a little bit of I don't know if it's a permaculture or a kind of a organic kind of sustainability quote, but the best time to plant a tree was 30 years ago, and the second best time is today. So it's kind of emphasizing that You know, you start with where you're at. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's interesting that, you know, we talk about kind of this evolving, you know, having your ethics at times evolve, and whether it's your spiritual journey, whether it's your own health, learning more about your own body of what works. You know, I shared with you before, it's even having put, you know, decades and a lot of thought into my food choices and developing my ethics around food that really closely follow permaculture, I have a litmus test of, you know, I have to be able to show it. I have to be able to see it and experience it, because there's just so much, and it kind of goes back to all this, you know, people have opinions and projecting them onto others. You know, me as a homesteader and following the kind of the philosophy of permaculture, many things I try to put into practice. And, you know, one of the areas I think I told you before, I'm having, you know, concern around, you know, production of pork. I am a bacon eater. I love pork, but, you know, I've tried raising pigs twice now on my property and have had very poor success in terms of, you know, this, you know, not being able to do it in a way that I don't have to load them up with antibiotics, not doing it in a way where they don't get to, you know, live a life that resembles what, you know, a pig, you know, would do somewhat in the wild. You know, and not having success causes me to kind of evolve that view. And I'm at a point where I think I'm going to give it a third time in the next year or so. But, you know, at the end of the day, for me, the litmus test is, if I can't show that this food item can be done in a way that I view is ethical treatment of the animal, that doesn't require, you know, these practices that we see on large scale food factories, and I can't do it in a way that also benefits the planet in terms of regenerating the soil, you know, I'm going to have to modify my views on it. And, you know, I think that's an interesting piece of this kind of conversation, is that you have to be open. And that's, I really liked your point about listening, where, you know, I would much rather somebody tell me about how they've applied, you know, ethical food choices in their own life and the impact that they've had, and what it's done for their you know, health and their spiritual life, and then have somebody tell me all the reasons that I need to make adjustments. Yeah. It's that, you know, back to that concept of kind of listening first and leaving an opportunity there. I really liked your point about leaving an opportunity for somebody who has a different opinion, because it seems like as a society, that's where we've just kind of fallen into whatever labels or whatever kind of camps we're in, and just not open to even having conversation. It's crazy, that kind of the world, the way it's headed.
Yeah, I agree. It's I've had some volatile, one way you and I came together was in our shared experience of having, I think, a lack of support for our choices in a lot of different areas of our life, and regarding, you know, family and loved ones and friends and that kind of thing. Because same with me, you know, I remember being out to dinner once when I was really taking a good, serious, you know, thought about making impacts, changes in my diet. And I was at a restaurant and I asked if they had any meatless burgers, like a veggie burger or something. And the person who I was, one of the people I was eating with, who I didn't know too well, was sitting there. And he was like, he didn't like that I wanted that, basically. And so then there was a band there, and I think it was the 4th of July, and they started playing some, I don't know if it was like America the Beautiful, or it was something really patriotic, and it sounded great. And I was like, are they playing America the Beautiful? And that guy goes, yeah, it's about as American as eating meat, huh? And I was like, well, all right, whatever. You know, but so there's been things like that. Definitely the conflicts of or the challenges anyway of going home for holidays, like to visit my parents or something. My dad eats about a 90% meat diet, and that's maybe a low ball estimate. I'm not sure what he eats other than like beef and chicken, but my wife and I went and visited them in Florida a couple years ago, and we were just making this you know, going meatless and dairyless together at the time. And it was really pretty cool. It was very supportive. And we went down to visit my parents in Florida, and we had like our own rack of ribs the first night. And then we ate like this grilled chicken the second night. And then we ate fish the third night, and then steaks the fourth night, you know? And we had for months not been eating any meat or dairy. And so we just got this like chewed us up. Our digestion was all screwed up, but my parents didn't really want to hear about it, about the diet or anything like that. We asked them to like consider it and get some other things or let us cook one night or something. And they didn't even really listen about any of it. And then once my mom kind of started listening a little bit after a while, and then she realized that like maybe I want to offer them something other than what they usually get here, and then she was kind of always checking with us to make sure, which was nice of her, but then I felt bad about that. And I'm like, you know what, I'm not going into anybody else's home and making demands or making any kind of being any kind of particular about what they're going to serve me, you know, because that seems to me bordering sometimes on being ungrateful, you know?
Sure.
And so that's a bit what some of my experiences have been with it. It's a journey, you know, I fall off of the diet, but I'm interested too. I don't want to take control of the podcast. I'm sure you have something on this later, but I just wanted to make sure we got to the climate change point that you keep, because you've mentioned that is, I think maybe like a place where you're definitely having a view that's not the same as vegans or something. And so,
real quick, I just, you made me think of one other thing. And there's a really successful kind of micro farmer. His name's Curtis Stone. And he developed a model up in Canada to kind of produce a six-figure income in producing high-value crops in a backyard. You know, he's a really... I've listened to him a couple of times, and he's got some great books out there. But when he started, he was, and this is actually be a good segue into our next kind of piece of this. But, you know, when he started, he had this vision of his ethics, and he thought that he could, he had a bicycle to deliver all his crops to his restaurant customers. And, you know, I heard him interviewed one time, and I think he made a good point, which kind of goes back to you know, your story of kind of, you know, being a guest in people's homes. And he said he learned that in business, he needs to keep his ethics in his back pocket. It's with him always. And he pulls it out as time, you know, as he needs it, but he doesn't lead with it. And so it allowed him to make decisions like actually buying a truck to deliver and expand his business. You know, making that point that, you know, he always kind of keeps his ethics with him, but it's not in your face like, I'm trying to push my, you know, what I believe on everyone else. And I think that's definitely the case. And, you know, your story of the restaurant, the 4th of July, I mean, it's amazing how people will just kind of project their views onto others. Like somehow you think, you know, you have the right way. And, you know, who is this guy? I think he is ordering a veggie burger. And, you know, it's just the examples of that are crazy. But one area that I would say that when I hear people talk about that, you know, like veganism is the way to feed the planet, you know, I struggle a little bit because I think you have a bit of a protein issue, and I think we're way too heavily reliant on soy, corn, and monocrops. You know, and I, as we look at healing the planet, you know, just for instance, the whole concept of, you know, that cows are the, you know, a negative impact on the planet. You know, in this country, we have, you know, probably about 90 million cattle raised annually. And, you know, we can surely point out all of the areas that they're causing destruction through the way that they're factory farmed. CAFO, for anybody listening, contained animal feed operation, you're talking about, you know, potentially, you know, hundreds if not thousands of cows being crammed into a place not much larger than a football field. And then, you know, back to the whole kind of permaculture, you got to take into account all the inputs And at that scale, it's just, it's a destructive environment. But there's guys throughout this country that are finding a different way. And, you know, I encourage folks to look into, it's a little bit easier to kind of to absorb or to digest this concept of regenerative agriculture, where we're actually doing practices that make the soil more organically rich. So, you know, there's a great YouTube video. There's a guy out there, Gabe Brown out of Wisconsin, and he made the conversion over to organic farming probably 20 years ago. And every year he had his soil tested, and every year by following these practices, the organic matter, the topsoil grew, the organic matter grew, and it had more to do with taking the animals, in his case, I think chickens, beef, and maybe even pork, and integrating them in a ethical way on the land so that they weren't just depleting and destroying it. So one of the things that folks in this space really understand is that, you know, if you let grass grow, let any plant grow, the most of the nutrients are pushed out into the new growth. It makes sense. It's, you're growing a piece of grass. So that, you know, the top inch of that is actually going to taste sweeter. There's going to be more sugars in there. There's more nutrients. But so as you rotationally graze animals and not letting them eat all the grass all the way to the ground, but only letting them kind of nibble the top, you know, quarter or third of it before you move them on to the next pasture, they're going to be happier because that's what they want to eat. And it's when you leave them in a situation where they have to eat it all to the ground, it's kind of disrupting that balance of nature. So I think my issue with vegetarianism or veganism as a way to feed the planet, it's heavily reliant around the idea of monocropping, which is highly destructive to our topsoil and our organic matter in the soil. So that's kind of where I come from that. I do see people that, you know, there are, you know, there is kind of a vegetarian or a vegan group within permaculture. But I think folks that really understand this philosophy deeply would admit that, you know, animals play a part in it. You know, we're part of this earth. Animals are part of this earth. And back to the kind of the cattle point, you know, yes, we might raise 90 million cattle annually, but it wasn't but a few hundred years ago that there were 60 million bison that roamed North America and did exactly what I'm describing as these successful regenerative agriculture farmers are doing. Is, you know, they grazed, they trampled, they fertilized, and they actually enriched the soil rather than depleted it, which is the current model. Sorry to go off on a soapbox.
No, there, I got but... my view on that is I think one thing that is got to be said about vegans or veganism, I guess, is the growth of the industry is one thing that I think we're in it. It's real time happening, like blowing up. I mean, it kind of did a year or two ago or three, but now we're in that stride, like it's still growing. And so I think with that, it comes problems of the same kind of problems are along the same lines of any massive organization like big agriculture or something. I mean, the bigger the vegan industry does, it's going to be big vegan eventually, right? And so to produce all these impossible burgers and to produce how many thousands or even millions of gallons of like almond milk and to do all that, like whatever you have to do on whatever scale to do, I mean, it's a large scale, and it's certainly like I think that's part of what's going on with the practices that go into like large scale vegan food production, like processed vegan food, basically. And so it's a thing for sure. I do have a strong, I mean, not strong. I just have a pretty good belief, I guess, in some of the movies that I've seen, and I'm sure you've seen them, Josh, and the interested listeners have, but things like Cowspiracy and What the Health and all these different movies, they're certainly just way super biased. I mean, you know, and sure. So it's like you have to, again, maintain an awareness of what you're consuming when you're watching it, like knowing that this is promoting veganism. This isn't like a research study that we're listening to. This is a show that someone paid a lot of money to promote veganism, right? These aren't like simply superheroes who just want to save your life, right? There's money involved in that movie. Sure. And so I think vegans, I don't know if it's because they feel different than others or if there's like a little naivety going on there because it's, there's still this, I feel like, sense of newness about the vegan industry. Vegans tend to buy the information that they're given hook, line, and sinker. Like if a new study comes out, you know, if some vegan website or whatever is posting the new studies that come out, I mean, it's like being a Democrat and going and watching CNN, right? And so it's like it's, you're just going there to hear the information that you want to hear, but there's other information out there. And so that's one of my issues with vegan. And so really, to me, what I like to get it, I don't like to eat processed vegan food. I mean, I do eat it, but I it's not my favorite, my best choice or whatever. And so I like eating whole foods and then just, and then making sure. the food in the kitchen. And to do that, I like to shop at farmers markets preferably, but you know, stores like Wegmans and Giant have an organic section that I honestly don't completely trust, but I think it's better than the non-organic, at least in some way. It certainly costs more, but so I buy those kinds of things and then I like to cook them on my own. I feel like with what I understand you saying about permaculture and this idea of caretaking the earth and keeping the whole organism really in mind when you're eating, it's like you're taking yourself in mind, you're taking the animal and the species in mind, like the environment that we're living in mind and all that kind of stuff. And so that's all like right on par with what my ethics are. I think and even I envision it this way, like, let's say you and I, and or any two people who like are of our, have our diets or whatever, lived way out. Like I'm talking at least 100 or 200 miles away from anything. And all we did was we had two farms and we lived like half a mile apart from each other. And on your farm with your family, you raised pigs and cows and chickens and bees and all kinds of different crops. And your family primarily ate all that. And then over my place, we didn't have any animals that we were, but we had the crops the same. And we just all sat around eating that stuff because that's what we wanted to eat. And then, like, what sure. would be the problem with that? Who cares, right? Like, you guys eat that, yeah. we eat this. And so the only real point of diversion I have from everything I've heard you say, it boils down to this, honestly, the spiritual ethic that I maintain about sure. life. But even then, I would have to say it's really the tenet is about suffering, like, don't cause suffering. And so then there's different implications of that sometimes, because ethical hunters are, I mean,
sure. Well, I love where you're going. I love where you're going right, with all yeah. this.
Well, I'm saying like there could be I feel like even though Buddhism's very clear about it, I think in practice, there's a sliding scale of what there's like a tipping point of is how much suffering, you know, when we euthanize our pets, we're really dealing with a sliding scale of suffer a cost benefit, really, like a scale of suffering in life, no suffering in death. Like, where is this animal on the spectrum? Yeah. So, and in yeah. that case, like, I'll take the animal to have its life, to have it put down, you know. So in that, sure. I'm taking life, but there's some sort of gray area ethical kind of consideration there, right? And so I think the same thing sure. When I talk to people who I would judge to be ethical hunters, I hear them talking in that kind of language about it.
Sure. Yeah. I got to jump in here. You touched on so many great points and I love, you know, the farm story. I would take it even one step further in terms of, yes, the farms are integrated where the beautiful beets and kale that you're growing on your vegetarian or vegan farm, might be fertilized by the compost that I produce that's just robust with nutrients, because I'm using chicken manure and wood chips and organic material. And, you know, it's that balance. And, you know, again, recognizing that most of what we're doing currently as a society is wrong, that there's this so much open space that, you know, there is no one solution that's going to fix it all. It's about coming in balance. And, you know, a lot of the thoughts that I've put around food, I mentioned the pigs, you know, a couple of thoughts there. I also have this belief as a homesteader, adhering to these permaculture principles, that there's probably a kind of a self-regulating component to this, where the amount of energy, and this is where, you know, if I were to grow soy or wheat or corn on my homestead in any sizable amount of production, there's an incredible amount of work that goes into that. There's another concept that's a huge piece of this. And there's a guy, Mark Shepard, that wrote a book called Restoration Agriculture. I almost called it regenerative. It's real close, but Restoration Agriculture. And it's a wonderful read. And it really focuses on how we as a society need to move away from annual crops and move to more perennial based. There's less energy involved. It creates better, you know, runoff of less erosion. It's just when you're planting annuals, you're tilling the field, you're planting the crops, you're irrigating, you're fertilizing, then you're harvesting. If you think about perennial based food systems that involve fruit and nut trees that are habitat for life and can be harvested and don't need to be replanted every year, it's a major difference in focusing on a society that's more perennial based as opposed to annual based. And, you know, all of these pieces are all where it's like you just hit the gold mine in terms of the ethical eating. You know, the pigs I talk about, you probably, if you're a homesteader, you know, one of the things I recognize, I mentioned, I love bacon. Well, you know, if I'm going to take responsibility for that portion of my food that I consume, I have to own the whole pig. You know, I have to make sure that I know ways to cook every cut of meat and utilize every bit of that, because again, I'm not going to take lightly the fact that I'm choosing to end an animal's life to provide food for myself and my family. I'm not going to, you know, the idea, and you touched on the hunting, the concept of trophy hunting is appalling and disgusting to me. But as a sustenance hunter, looking at a situation where we've destroyed so much of natural deer population, we both live in Pennsylvania and it's a major issue. I drive past, you know, 9 deer carcasses every day that on my way to work that have been hit by cars, just with no thought or care or use from them. And then I think about, you know, when I, and, you know, I know it probably is not something that folks, you know, that aren't into hunting understand or might have a trouble understanding, but when I put an arrow through a deer at 300 feet per second, and it takes 2 feet and drops dead, that is the most peaceful, the less painful, the less, the best way that deer is going to pass in our world, rather than dying of starvation, yeah, disease, getting hit by a car. And so it is an ethical move. And, you know, I have friends that are hunters. There's a young man that I work with that kind of got into this permaculture, you know, and he talked about saying a prayer after, you know, thanking the deer for giving its life to provide food for its family. It's, you know, we see this with indigenous cultures. They've long understood that, you know, it's a gift and it's not something to be taken lightly. I have a brother-in-law that is a much better hunter than I am. And he had a situation where he ended up injuring and not dropping a deer and hitting it in the leg and tracking it. And he tracked it for hours, and he couldn't sleep that night over the thought of that what he had caused, you know, hours and hours into the darkness trying to find where this deer may have ended up, because he just couldn't accept that he had caused that and caused suffering that didn't need to happen. I mean, he's hunted lots of deer and, you know, put a lot of meat on the table as a result. But, you know, it's interesting, the folks that don't think about these things, you know, as I referenced the, you know, some of the challenges I had with pigs, I had a pig a few years ago that I had to stand up three times a day because it had a problem with its hips. And, you know, I thought, oh, I have this responsibility for this animal. I have to care for it when it's in my, you know, on my farm and part of my care. And, you know, and having a loss of an animal that you hope to harvest and provide, you know, calories and nutrition to you and your family. I remember a coworker, I was talking about having a rough weekend of having lost a pig and, you know, and to disease, and I had to bury it and how upsetting it was. And, you know, this woman turned to me and said, well, what did you care? You were going to kill it and eat it. And it's like, well, no, I do care, because I think I have a responsibility as a meat eater to understand these concepts on a deeper level. And yeah, I mean, that's where I think we have the most opportunity, Kevin, is really to be more mindful of our food choices, of what impact does it have on not just, you know, other people, but also the planet.
You know what, too, I was going to say, I think, like, cause I, you know, we're probably winding down here, but I think I would like to say that the other thing is, go back to the example that I said about being, having our two farms next to each other, and about how we can be content with whatever we're cultivating ourselves. Right. But the other thing we can do is we can also have an intention to share with each other in that scenario. And this is for all the people. And what I mean is, yeah, like I have my ethics and my diet over here, and you've got your ethics and your diet over there, and we're happily, you know, happy in our ethics and our diets. But there's a value also to sharing, in the same way that you would go to some other country even to immerse yourself in a culture or experience the way somebody else does it. Like, people don't have a problem going over to Italy and talk about how amazingly different the Italians are, right? Or whatever, I'm just saying.
Sure.
So it's, we can share, and then we can like try to develop a deeper understanding for our neighbors and have that be a characteristic of our community. And then we're achieving our goal of, we're living more harmoniously, and it's, you know, to be vulnerable and open to share and to be able to embrace something different that somebody else does. Sharing it and remaining open is like the antidote to people getting on each other's cases all the time, you know?
For sure. Yeah, that touches on that, you know, the third permaculture ethic, which is return to surplus and, you know, and giving as much as you're receiving, giving back. And, you know, from my point of view, nature is so bountiful. If we can learn to live in balance with Mother Nature and take the gifts that she provides. And, you know, that farm analogy is spot on, because, you know, as a beekeeper, and, you know, I think it's interesting, you kind of mentioned the almond milk. It's one of my, I know you heard me talk about it before, but, you know, this kind of consistency where, you know, if, you know, vegans that, you know, would not consume honey because it's a byproduct of animal may not understand that, you know, every bit of almond milk is part of a process that involves honeybees. Every almond is pollinated by a honeybee.
Right.
And so many people don't know that in this country, you know, hundreds of thousands of hives of bees are transported across the country in tractor trailers just to pollinate California's almond fields. And it's, you know, I love where you going with this. You know, it's about local, it's about eating whole food, it's about knowing what you're eating based on your personal ethics, and leaving that opportunity for somebody else who might have a different view, and what, you know, that concept of, you know, being able to share and learn and experience new culture. I think it's spot on. I mean, yeah, we're probably wrapping up here, but I think, like I said, there's so much overlap in terms of, you know, our views, that, you know, to think that a meat eater who is a hunter, you know, what are they going to have in common with a vegetarian with vegan tendencies? I'm so glad that, you know, you were able to join me as my first guest on this podcast, because I think this is a fundamental conversation that if you're going to head down this path in whatever way it takes you, you know, leave room open for others that have different views. Look to share and help your, you know, your fellow neighbor with whatever you're able to produce. If it's just knowledge, this is a great conversation, Kevin. I think it's, I really appreciate you taking the time to join.
No problem. I think what we ought to do in the future, like even if it's just once a year, or if your podcast completely blows up, because I'm not so sure about mine right now, but what we can do is, you know, there's all kinds of new research all the time that comes out. And what we could do is we could pick, and then there's also all kinds of reviews of the new research that come out. And then that's like, wait, it's like, it's kind of like summaries basically. But we could each take a look at one that talks about something new that's going on and what our area of interest is. And then we can bring that, and that can be like the core of the discussion. So you'd look up something on permaculture and, you know, ethical eating and whatever, and I would look up some things on vegetarianism, maybe the vegan industry, and then we come and give reports to each other and talk about how appalled we are with the other person's point of view.
I think this is the types of conversation that need to occur on all variety of subjects, because you know, mutual respect, you know, a real interest in learning another person's point of view. And I think back, you said, you know, some of these documentaries that, you know, push one agenda. You can fall down the rabbit hole. I spent over 6 hours, you know, listening to a debunking of the Game Changers documentary about vegan athletes, and then a debunking of the debunking, and it, you know, and it's like in the end of it, I'm just exhausted having listened to 6 hours of people going back and forth and, you know, trying to get this gotcha moment. And at the end of it, I'm like, you know, having really listened and watched the film and, you know, there's just, why are we looking for areas that were different? Why aren't we looking for areas that were the same, that we can move the dial a little bit, as opposed to trying to point out, ha, that person's wrong because they believe this, or, you know, I really, you know, your friendship has been, and if you haven't checked out Seeds of Liberation, check out your podcast is good. And I think I liked your episode on friendship. You know, you got some great stuff out there. I'm looking forward to listening to your one that you recorded on this concept, because I think it'll be a nice kind of accompaniment to what we recorded here today. But yeah, just leaving that room for exploring new ideas and understanding that we're all on this journey, and we have to kind of evolve and develop our own thoughts. But
that's right. I think the best thing we can do, Josh, is just keep it going. Is just keep right. Talking, like, having dialogue about it. And two, I don't know of any other podcast going on right now where there is this type of episode where, you know, where it's like you pull into people with different views and do this kind of thing to bridge the gap and to show other people like what this kind of conversation is like. It's no big deal, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, I appreciate it though. Thanks for having me on, Josh.
All right, man. Well, I really appreciate it. And like I said, make sure you check out Kevin's podcast, Seeds of Liberation, available on Spotify, Apple, iTunes. You can find it out there. It's good stuff. So thanks a lot, man. And, you know, we got to find that opportunity to sit around a campfire and hear you jam on the mandolin a little bit too. So as soon as we get out of this coronavirus lockdown, we got to plan to get together.
Hey, the word on the street is that the International Bluegrass Music Association gave the green light for all festivals to be held this summer. Nice. So that's like hundreds of bluegrass festivals with, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that go attend them. So that's anyway, awesome. So maybe we'll be meeting up at a festival sometime.
For sure. I appreciate it. Hey, thanks.